done for 34 years now. This is September. September of 1982 is when it began, 34 years ago. This will be TechNet number 1618 of the series that started then. And when that series began, into FDJ and I, HIP, thought that we would answer people's questions over a couple of weeks and dry up and go away. And we soon realized there's a huge thirst for knowledge about radio circuits, radio propagation, ham radio-like subjects. There's a huge thirst for that knowledge among the curious ham radio operators, a significant percentage of ham radio operators. I think there's really a scientist inside fighting to get out, and they want to know how things work. And so that thirst, an attempt to satisfy that thirst, is what the TechNet has been doing for 34 years. We don't have perfect accuracy. Each of the answers you get live when you ask your question by the people who are participating occasionally has some errors, but you could say it is peer-reviewed material. Let me drop. Because the last 10 years, the last solid 10 years of TechNet are recorded, and you can go to the website by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, but that website is at, all of a sudden I forgot the name, TechNet.com, wait a minute now, all of a sudden I've forgotten the name of the, hey John, what's the address for the website? I just thought of it, amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and you'll see the last 10 years of TechNet. So if you're unable to stay up that late to listen to this TechNet, which goes on for 4 hours, starts at 8 and ends at midnight, and some people can't stay up that late, but a few days downrange, this recording will appear on that website. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week. Download the audio into whatever system you've got, and therefore you can listen to it on the train, while you're traveling to work, on your lunch hour, whatever, if that's what you want to do. There is another website that supports the TechNet, and that's the one by Mike number 2, K1MJM, and that's at limarktechnet.com, and there you'll find a lot of supporting information. I noticed that there's one piece of information I thought was going to be there, and it's on the first website, and maybe Mike's going to correct that one. And it's a subject that probably will be discussed tonight. 2 weeks ago, I think it was, Ed, KC2PYT, asked us a very provocative question about fulfilling the FCC requirement. Let me drop. As Ed brought to our attention, if you're radiating more than 50 watts on a VHF frequency, more than 49 but less than 51, as Ed put it, if you're radiating 50 watts, in theory, you're on the hook to do a calculation of how safe, from a radio frequency biohazard point of view, how safe is your setup. And at first that sounds like a fairly complicated thing, like it would take some fairly expensive test equipment to confirm that in a way that's traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. If Ed is on tonight and we do go through that subject, you'll see that there's a lot of very good news along those lines. Nowhere near as bad as you think. The equipment required to make the measurement, you already own it. It's just a matter of using it intelligently. Let me drop.
It's DPZ Moe's quickie answers. Okay, Dick?
Yeah, the group of people who run this TechNet, or K2RIW, you're listening to him, John KC2WGB, Paul WS2N with the Space Report, John monitors the Echo Link and IRLP, also maintains the mailbag, and from time to time we get answers from Al K6DPZ, who claims to have the brief answers, because there are people who think my answers are verbose, which occasionally they are. When it comes to, do people want long or short answers? A couple of times per year we ask that question, and we usually get a very interesting answer. Please be more brief. But when you get to my particular subject, don't be brief. I want to hear the whole story. So you can see what's going on here. Let me drop.
By the way, my Hal name is Hal in parentheses. Okay.
Okay, that person who just talked dropped out a few times, but he said his name is Hal. K6DPZ is Hal, the guy with the brief answers. That's what was dropping out and what he was trying to say. Alrighty, the very loose schedule we use on the TechNet, for the first approximately 1 hour, people check in because they do have a question or a comment. They give us their call letters, their name, and they go on the list, and we, in order, go through their particular question. As I was starting to say earlier, the material that's on the website, amateurradio.tangovictor, because lots of people review it, when errors are discovered, those errors are brought to our attention. That's what I say. The material is, to a good degree, peer-reviewed material, so eventually you get the right answer, even though we might have some errors at first. One of the things that every real engineer has to realize is that no matter how hard he tries, he's going to have a certain batting average, but nobody bats 1,000. No matter how hard you try, you're going to occasionally make an error. And turns out Winston Churchill had a very interesting subject, a way of discussing that. Let me drop. Yeah, Winston Churchill, he said that if you try, you risk failure. If you don't try, you guarantee it. So we do try to give people answers. We occasionally make some mistakes and have some failure. But that's brought to our attention and it eventually gets corrected. So the first hour, questions and answers. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, with the mailbag. And what the mailbag represents, let me drop it. It represents people who don't yet have the right ham license, don't yet have the right equipment, so they can talk to us directly. Quite often these are students in high school, college, whatever, with radio-like questions. And so John, he has on occasion gotten as many as 76 letters, so to speak, in one particular week. He chooses the ones that he thinks have general interest, and we go through a few of those. We spend in the vicinity of an hour doing that. So an hour with the questions and answers of people who signed in, about an hour sometimes with the mailbag material. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert, and he'll be giving a space report tonight, number 218 of the series. And so Elon Musk and other people are doing some exciting things. There was a launch this week of, I can't even think of the name of the thing. It's going to be going for a... going to a asteroid I think it's going to an asteroid.
That's right. WS2N.
What was that again, Paul? The name of the name of the launch, and what's the name of the thing that it's heading for to gather some material a couple years downrange? Over to you, Paul.
It's going to be new, the asteroid, and the name of the spacecraft is OSIRIS-REx. It's a big, long acronym. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we're going to have to ask you what that stands for. That's a joke, of course. That doesn't really matter. And then, that's the very loose schedule. By loose schedule, I mean if people really get excited on the subjects during the first hour at times has lasted as long as 2.5 hours, and so on. So each one of these things, we go with the flow. We play it by ear. Okay, so at this time, you're going to give me check-ins if you do have a question or a comment for the net. Particularly looking for Ed KC2 PYD to check in because we've got some good news for him.
Repeater, timeout.
As I said, we do have some good news for him 2 weeks downrange. So give me your call letters and name. A typical sign-in would sound like this. KC2 PYD, Ed, and yes. So give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2RI will be listening.
Oh, Dick. And 2 AL with a comment.
The B2RY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we've got Rich and Joe. And anyone else, just check in with a question or a comment. Give me your call letters right now. K2RI will be listening. KC2PYT, and as I said, you asked a darn good question, and you're going to get a significant answer tonight. And from my point of view, 99% of it's good news. And the concern you had, you're soon going to discover, is almost not a need for concern. But you'll get the specifics by which you can make the judgment yourself as to whether or not there's a real need for further concern. So we've got Rich, Joe, and Ed in that order. Anyone else to check in because you do have a question or comment? Give me your call letters and your name right now. K2RIW.
K2RIW.
NY2HF for the question.
Okay, we got Eric and that mysterious person without a name, NY2HF, which I bet you his name is Dennis, because he's checked in Saddam many times before. Okay, we got more than enough to get going. So, Rich, what's the latest in Massapequa Park? N2EO, K2RIW. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Just getting involved with slow scan television. I would encourage anybody on HF, 20 meters, they use 14 to 30, very nice mode. It's still, it's not moving video, but it's very nice. I'm getting the transmitter system running. I've had some software problems, but I've received some pictures from France and around the country, and it's a very nice mode. It used to cost thousands of dollars to buy dedicated equipment. Today, if you have a PC, you can do it for $200. There's a company out there called West Mountain Radio. They make interfaces, different types. This one here is called the Rick Blaster Advantage. It's $200, and one computer, one radio. They have others that you can run two computers, two radios. I don't need that. More expensive. There's also a company called Tigertronics. They sell an interface also. And I believe there are other companies. So I just wanted to comment on that, Dick. Also, I want to say I very much enjoy the Tech Net. I look forward to it every week, as you know. And I really think you belong on at least local television. Remember Mr. Wizard years ago, when we were kids. Back to Net and to Rio.
Steve, you have a comment.
Yeah, Hal, you're dropping out. You're only there 50% of the time. I'm going to give you some time to make a correction for that. I thank you for that comment, Rich. When it comes to slow scan television, you've now made a few QSOs with it. Out of curiosity, where is the closest person you've talked to with slow scan television, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't worked anybody yet because I'm still having trouble with a software bug, which I think is going to be fixed tonight. Bernie K2YO said to update the video driver from Hewlett-Packard because that's who makes my computer. Right now I'm doing software updates from Microsoft. And after they finish, I'm going to go into HewlettPackard.com and do an update there for the video driver. But, you know, it's a nice thing because you're marrying computers, graphics, and ham radio. I'm getting into computer graphics as well. I downloaded an old-time test pattern from the internet. Do you remember the ones with the Indian head? And I'm adding my call letters to it and CQ to it. And instead of black and white, it's going to come up in red. So it's a very nice thing. I'm going to enjoy it. Back to that and to Leo.
Okay, keep us posted on that one, Rich. So you haven't made any QSOs yet, and seen any pictures yet, and I guess the answer's got to be no because your software is not working. So I thought I heard you say earlier you know of people doing it, and you had QSOed. I guess you had QSOed people who are doing it, but you haven't yet seen their pictures. Is that true, Rich? In 2EO, K2LIW?
I said before, Dick, I can receive, I can't transmit yet. I've received the pictures from France and around the country.
Very good. And the closest person to your QTH where you have received a picture, roughly who was that? How close was the closest one, Rich? And I'm a little bit afraid there's probably not very many on Long Island right now. Over to you, Rich.
Running it on 20 meters, so the band's been terrible, but I did get some snowy pictures from the Midwest and West Coast, but the band's been awful.
And because of the skip zone, I'm guessing on 20 meters, quite often the closest person you'll talk to is Chicago, so to speak, and it's very different than 2 meters on that respect. Okay, good luck with that project, Rich. Joseph, to B2LYY. What's the latest in your neighborhood? You got it, Joe. K2LIW.
There we go. Good evening, Dick. To B2LYY. This question has to do with inductive reactants and capacitive reactants. If you pick components, you'll get certain values at a particular frequency in a circuit. And if you want to, apparently the way it looks like in the formula, if you pick a higher inductance like capacitor by a factor of like 10 times, you'll start apparently increasing the Q. If looking at it backwards, is there a formula for knowing, say, like the Q of the circuit to start with, what you want to end up with, of how you pick the inductive reactants, capacitive reactants in a particular circuit, to determine that, you know, to have the Q come out right back to you? That'll give you some, I think, give you some specific, you know, sort of just playing around with that on the calculator.
Now, when it comes to the formula, where if you know how many microhenry or henry you're working with, and if you know the frequency you're applying to it, 2 pi FL tells you how many ohms of inductive reactants you're going to get, and 1 over 2 pi FC tells you how many ohms of capacitance reactants you're going to get. The word Q is determining the so-called quality factor of your inductor and your capacitor. If your inductor was ideal, it would have a Q of infinity. One of the definitions for Q of an inductor is inductive reactance at your particular frequency divided by its apparent resistance. The word apparent resistance or equivalent series resistance is the real resistance it has to your radio wave, which in general is a little bit higher than what your ohm meter is going to measure. In many cases, you can put your ohm meter across, let's say, an inductor you're using for a power supply. You can measure the number of ohms. Let me drop on that one.
GPV is on that deck.
You got to be careful, though, when you do that, when you put your ohm meter across on the times one scale across an inductor. At the instant you disconnect those two leads, you're going to get an inductive kickback, and you're going to jump the voltage coming out. So on the subject of Q, apparently Hal has a comment on that. K6DPZ, K2IW. Go ahead, Hal.
Reactance over resistance. But what I wanted to say, if you want to determine the reactance of an inductor or a capacitor, a very easy way of doing it, you take a function generator, an audio oscillator, along with a carbon resistor, pot, put them in series, and adjust the pot, voltage drop across the pot, and voltage drop across your unknown inductor, the given frequency, and you can automatically then take the pot out, measure the resistance, and that is basically the reactance.
Yeah, what Hal just described is called the half voltage technique. By putting a variable resistor in series with the inductor, and you put your signal generator at the proper frequency across that combination, when you make the voltage drop across the inductor, measured with your AC voltmeter, and the voltage drop across the resistor, all by itself, with your AC voltage, when you make those two voltages the same, then the inductive reactance equals the value of your resistor. That tells you how much inductive reactance you've got. That doesn't tell you the Q. That doesn't tell you the equivalent series resistance of the inductor. So, is there a simple technique with your quickie answer on finding the equivalent series resistance at the operating frequency of the inductor? Over to you, Hal, K2RIW.
If it's switching your 3 dB points, pretty much the term. But the other thing is you use a digital voltmeter with high impedance, not a simple VOM, to measure the AC voltage across your inductor and your carbon pot. Just wanted to make sure that was understood there.
Yeah, you got to make sure that variable potentiometer is a purely resistive device. If it's wire wound, and if you're operating at high enough frequency, you can get some crazy results. So, there is a device called the Q-meter. General Radio made one. Hewlett-Packard made one. RCQ meter, which can measure the inductive reactance and the equivalent series resistance. The equivalent series resistance, the real way to measure that is to look at the phase shift. If your inductor was absolutely perfect, had zero equivalent series resistance, then the phase shift across the inductor versus the current, the voltage versus current, will be exactly 90 degrees out of phase. And if you could measure the number of degrees different. But we're probably putting a little bit too much emphasis on Q, because Q is the quality factor. You'd like it to be as high as possible. Particularly when you're building a filter. The Q of your components that go into a filter should determine whether or not the filter is going to give you nice, clean skirt factors on the rejection frequencies, as opposed to a kind of a sloppy filter. What do you do if you're winding your own coil in order to maximize the Q? I can tell you which direction to go. I can't tell you how far to go. Let me drop it.
Also, Bruton makes a Q-meter, a 260, which we have in our lab.
Okay, yep. You were only there 30% of the time, Hal, so we didn't really understand something about the lab. As you use a larger and larger diameter of wire that you wind your inductor, and larger and larger diameter, because inductance is a function of the number of turns, the permeability of the core, the diameter of the core. If you make the diameter large, and if you use a very large diameter wire, you're going to get a very high Q. Now, how far you go in that direction? I think your question, Joe, and I'm going to pass it back to you because we may be misinterpreting it, is I think you want to know how to maximize the Q and how much Q is required. On the better written articles for a filter, for instance, they'll tell you if you want full performance out of this filter, the inductors and the capacitors should have a Q of at least 50. You may see an answer like that. There also probably is a website that'll tell you what's the minimum Q requirement in order to get full performance out of a filter design, if that's what you're using the inductors and capacitors for. So I think you want to know how much Q is required. I'm going to pass it back to you for a confirmation of that, Joe. So if you reword the question, because quite often when you give me a question, I go off on a tangent in some crazy direction, and you have to give me the question a second or a third time. So I'm passing it back to you for the second or third time, Joe. W2RYY, it's not your fault, K2RIW.
Okay, I'll give you some real values and put this in a calculator to, if you want to check them. On a frequency of, say, I used it just for an example, a frequency of 60 hertz. You'll come up with a number of, say, 2,350, that's 2,650, somewhere around that,
factor 10 again. Now you're making those inductive reactants and capacitive reactant numbers a factor of 10 again. Now they're up to 100, and this is increasing the Q of the circuit or making it sharper. So that my original question was, is there a direct formula or something you can interpolate to put into a formula to come out with, say you want to make a circuit that has a Q of, say, 1,000. At a particular frequency, to start picking values that are going to make that circuit happen correctly. Now, do you follow?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Joe, you're giving us a portion of the picture. The picture is clear in your head, but you haven't given us enough of the details. By that I mean, you didn't say it, but since you're making, in your example, your capacitive reactance equal 1 ohm and your inductive reactance equal 1 ohm, and you're choosing values to do that, it would sound like you're trying to equal the inductive reactance and capacitive reactance as if you're making a 60 hertz resonator, series or parallel resonator. That's what it sounds like. And you're studying the values that keep the resonant frequency at 60 hertz, and yet it still keeps resonating, and you're looking for what LC ratio. In other words, I can use a great big inductor and a small capacitor, or vice versa, and I can still keep resonating at 60 hertz if that's what you're trying to do. So maybe you're looking for the best possible resonator at 60 hertz with an L and C being used together. Is that approximately what you're doing, Joe? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet. You're only there 10% of the time, Hal. So please try to correct that before you come back to us. Go ahead, Joe.
W2RYY. 60 hertz is just being used just on a calculator because of, you know, it's a lower number. It wasn't. I'm not designing something to work at 60 hertz. It could be 20 megahertz. It could be 250 megahertz. He's using me as an example, and I'm trying to just understand if there's a formula, get an idea if there's a formula to be able to take. To put into a formula to be able to say work a formula backwards, where if you want to end up with a Q of a circuit approximately, I understand that the resistance of the components affects the Q totally of the circuit. I do understand that, but like you see in general, what I'm talking about, as the inductor goes up and the capacitor goes down, you can still get it to resonate at the same frequency, but you're sharpening the response of these of this particular filter if you're using it like in a parallel circuit, like a tank circuit, something like that. Looking at it like that. Okay. That's basically what I'm getting at with the question I initially asked. Is there a formula to be able to tell you? All right, I want to end up with a Q of 1,000. Do I have to pick? I have to pick a certain inductive reactance component that will deliver that, and a certain capacitor value that will give me a certain inductive reactance at that frequency. Now, do you follow what I'm saying here?
Yes, I do, Joe. I'm getting more and more of the picture, and you're going down a road that many amateurs and electronic engineers have gone down, and they believe that the Q of the circuit that's doing the resonating is the primary factor. In many cases, it is not. It's the loading that you provide to your filter, we'll say, by way of your signal generator creates a certain load on the input end, and your output circuit creates a certain load on the output end. It's a little bit similar to what happens when you and I use a reentrant cavity filter, like the kind of filters we use on 2 meters and 440 in order to make a duplexer. That kind of a cavity resonator filter. An amazing number of engineers and ham radio operators have said, I want to tap it at the 50 ohm point. There is no 50 ohm point on that resonator. By the same token, if I take an inductor and a capacitor and I'm using it as a filter, there is no 50 ohm point. In other words, in the case of that reentrant cavity filter that we've used for duplexers, let me drop. There's many ways I can couple signal in and couple signal out. Usually it's done with a loop an inductive loop that couples the signal in and an inductive loop that couples the signal out. But you could do it with a straight piece of wire, large enough in diameter, that goes from the outer diameter and touches the center conductor, the center resonator. And depending on how far up from ground you put that input conductor and that output conductor, input tapping point and output tapping point, you either could have an extremely high Q filter with a fair amount of insertion loss, or an extremely low Q filter with very little insertion loss, but very little filtering. So there is no 50 ohm point. It's a function of how much loading you have decided. In the case of that cavity type reentrant filter, how far up from ground you tap it makes the determination. And so if you tap it very close to ground, you'll have an extremely sharp filter. If you tap it very far up from ground, you'll have a very broad filter. The actual resonator itself, you haven't changed. You've only changed the way you've tapped into it. Let me drop. So when I'm using an inductor and a capacitor at either a 60 hertz or a 50 megahertz filter, I'm making now a lumped circuit filter. The real Q under operating conditions is a function of how heavy you loaded it. In the case of a PI filter network, the output network of your tube amplifier quite often is a PI filter network. And if you study what that circuit really is, you've got an input capacitor, an inductor, and an output capacitor. If you redraw the circuit, those two capacitors are in series with each other. There just happens to be a grounding point in the middle between the two. So the sum of those two capacitors is the capacitor that your inductor is resonating with. But depending on the ratio of those capacitors, that's your loading factor. With the output capacitor, we usually call it the loading capacitor. If you start setting it for very low capacitance values, you have a very heavily loaded circuit. And conversely, if you use it, the output capacitor, very high capacitor value, you have a very lightly loaded circuit, and you develop some huge circulating voltages and currents. So what I'm getting at is the Q of your PI network is a function of how heavily you load it, how you set those capacitor ratios. That's what really determines the working Q. Let me drop. There's a certain minimum Q of the inductor and capacitors you should be using. You're not going to use miniature components on a kilowatt amplifier. So there's a certain minimum Q required of the capacitors and inductors all by themselves. But under working conditions, the loading factor you've chosen is the major determining factor that determines how sharp a filter you get, how much excess insertion loss, and so there's a bunch of complicated formulas. We're not going to go there tonight, where if you know the basic Q of your inductors and capacitors, and after you have chosen the loading factors for input loading and output loading, then there's a way you can estimate what is the insertion loss and how sharp is the filtering going to be. But under real working conditions, the dominant factor that gives you the working Q is the loading factor. Most of the time, that dominates a lot over the actual inductors and capacitors you've chosen, assuming you're above a certain minimum for your particular power level. That's some of the information. I'm putting myself in your shoes, and I know that I would not be completely happy with that answer. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, reword the question if you want some more info, Joe, K-2-R-I-W. What you're into here is a not-so-simple circuit analysis problem. You got it, Joe.
Okay, W2OY. I don't understand the circuit loading affects the Q of the circuit, but you're still not maybe directly answering the question that I initially asked. But I guess there's a way of doing it, but I'm not hearing it here. You know, I'll give you a practical example of where I saw something like this. Using a particular ratio of components. Years and years ago, when I was involved in the fire department, they used a receiver, and the tone circuits in the receiver were extremely sharp. They were only responsive to a particular tone frequency, and only by a couple of hertz each way, plus or minus. So the circuit was fairly sharp. And I looked at the schematic of the thing and to see what they were actually doing with this LC ratio, and the component
I'll give you an example. One frequency was about 1598 hertz. And the circuit had to be responsive to. And there was other ones, varies, you know, other ones and other frequencies also. But the component they used for the L was about 0.75. I think 0.75 Henry, something like that. Yeah, 0.75 H was the L. And if you work the form in the backwards with the capacitor came out to be something like 0.013 and change microfarads. And they actually used trimmable RF capacitors, they look like. That would give you some sort of variation in that circuit across the fixed capacitors to exactly tune the frequency, exactly to have a response and exact total frequency. But this is where the question sort of really basically comes from.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, and I'm listening to myself on the output of the autonomous hello. Somebody initially in the design of that circuit wanted to come up with a certain Q and a certain bandwidth, which the Q is going to be related to make that circuit respond to something, some total frequency, but only be plus or minus a few hertz. So that frequency, say, like, you know, 10 hertz, 15 hertz, I forget what the exact tolerance ended up actually being in reality. But it was meant to be fairly sharp. This is basically where the question comes from. You know, they picked a certain high L value and a certain capacitor value to match it to make it resonate at a particular frequency. And like again, I'll say it again: is there a formula where if you want to start knowing that you want to, you know, come up with a certain Q in a circuit, being a series resonant circuit or parallel resonant circuit? I understand that circuit loading affects things also. But is there a certain formula that gives you a basic idea where using a certain value is going to be, give you, so much as far as, contributing to the Q of the circuit overall? Back to you.
By the way, those values you gave us were very close. You said 0.75 Henry, 0.013 microfarad, and that calculates to be a resonant frequency of 1612 hertz, and you were looking for 1.598, close enough, and of course we're rounding things off here. I'm going to give you another example that may help a little bit. Way back in the dark ages when I was first getting on 6 meters, I knew I wanted to build myself a synthesized signal generator. The definition of synthesized in those days was not a digital circuit. It was an analog circuit where you had a variable oscillator mixing together with a crystal oscillator and coming out with 50 megahertz. And what I chose was a variable oscillator that ran from 9 to 10 megahertz. And if I mixed that with a 41 megahertz crystal, 41 plus 9 gave me 50. So the first sweep of the dial, when I swept the variable oscillator from 9 to 10, mixing with 41, it swept from 50 to 51 megahertz. Okay, let me drop. I wanted this synthesized signal generator, not a signal generator, a synthesized exciter. It was a 1 watt exciter for the 6 meter band. I wanted it to have very little drift. I wanted it to have very little chirp. Therefore, I know that I was using an oscillator transistor called 2N384. It's a 100 megahertz capable crystal in the early days of the late 50s, early 60s. It was a state-of-the-art transistor with very low capacitance, very high frequency capability, but I'm using it way down at 9 to 10 megs. It had a couple of picofarad of real capacitance, and I know that as the transistor heated up, that couple of picofarad would change a little bit. I knew that if I put it across a coil with a whole lot of capacitor and a very small inductor, I know that the small amount of capacitance change of the transistor would have very little effect. So I made that 9 to 10 megacycle oscillator. This is now 9 to 10 megs, and I'm doing it with a 365 picofarad air variable capacitor. That was the air variable capacitor, and it was another capacitor shunted across it. And that was going across a coil that was made out of 14-gauge wire, as I remember. And I put that into a nice sealed box. That oscillator, that variable frequency oscillator, you could turn it on and off by turning on the B-plus to it, and you heard no chirp. In other words, the capacitance of the resonator was so high. high compared to the transistor I was using. Whether the transistor was ice cold, just starting up, full voltage, half voltage, whatever, it had that one single resonant frequency. There was no chirp to it. So I chose an extremely high C to L ratio in order to swamp the capacitance of the 2N384 transistor to have very little chirp. And I could key that oscillator. I didn't actually do that. The final circuit was keying the crystal-controlled oscillator. But I could key the VFO. So in
repeater, timeout.
In that particular case, I could have gone down the road calculating what is the resultant Q of the LC ratio of the variable capacitor plus inductor I was using for that variable frequency oscillator. Q would not be it. I was swapping the one thing, the electronic circuit had one active component, a 2N384 transistor. The transistor has got C swing. In other words, as you change the voltage on it, the equivalent capacitance on its base and its collector, the equivalent capacitance in picofarads would change. I didn't care about Q. I wanted to swamp the effect of the transistor's change in capacitance by using a huge C to L ratio. And it solved my problem. So there's more than Q evolved in some cases. So in that particular case, I wasn't trying to get a resonator that had a very sharp curve to it. I didn't care if the curve was broad, sharp, or whatever, as long as it was an extremely steady frequency with no drift and no chirp. So there's more involved than just Q in many cases, Joe. The Q of a... Let me drop this. There's one other interesting formula I can tell you about that'll slightly give you information on the road you're going down, and that is every circuit that has inductors and capacitors, the inductors and capacitors as a resonator have a natural Q, the unloaded Q. Now, depending on the loading factor you've chosen, you now have a loaded Q, okay? If you know the unloaded Q to loaded Q ratio, and you take that ratio and you subtract it from 1, take the square root of it and 1 over, what I'm getting at is there is a formula that'll tell you exactly what insertion loss you're going to get from a filter network if your resonators, if you know, calculate, or could measure the unloaded Q and the loaded Q for the way you're using it. There's a formula you can plug that into that'll tell you exactly what insertion loss you're going to get. There is another formula, which I don't know right now, which will tell you how broadband, what's the 3 dB bandwidth going to be. Let me back on that one. Q has got a whole lot of definitions, 5 definitions that I know of. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Inductive reactance divided by resistance. Rate of change of phase versus frequency. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. There's 5 different definitions of Q. You think there's 5 different definitions, there's 5 different kinds of Q. They're all the exact same phenomena, just different ways of measuring it. Let me choose the first one, voltage rise at resonance. If you've chosen a certain tap ratio into your resonator so that the 1 volt coming out of your signal generator is, you know, 1 turn up on the coil, so to speak. You're plugging in 1 volt from your signal generator, and now you measure the voltage in a very lightly loaded circuit. You measure the voltage on the top of the resonator, and if you find it's 100 volts, that's the voltage rise at resonance. In other words, the peak voltage in your circuit is 100 volts, but you're applying 1 volt to it. That's a ratio of 100 to 1. It would suggest you've got a working Q of 100, voltage rise at resonance. Any resonator, somewhere inside of that resonator, let me drop. Somewhere inside of that resonator, the voltage is higher than the voltage that you've applied. The current is higher than the current that you've supplied. The 3 dB bandwidth divided by center frequency, the center frequency divided into the 3 dB bandwidth, that's another definition of Q. So there's lots of ways you can measure it. You think you've got 5 different definitions. It's all the exact same phenomena, the resonating phenomena, the amount of loss that's in there because of series resistance and so on. So you've got 5 different ways of measuring it, but still they're all measuring the same thing. I know I'm not directly directly answering your question, but I'm giving you information about Q and how many engineers use the concept of Q. To be K2LYY, K2LIW. Feed us another question on this one, Joe.
Well, you know, it was more or less just a curiosity thing. I mean, I've got an actual question related to, not Q, but something related to using capacitors, a capacitive, you know, value of a particular component, and inductive, well, what I mean, the inductive. Well, let me ask that one. This is, it's a little bit of an offshoot of this thing. I took an LED, I changed a couple of fixtures in the house. I happened to change not in the fixtures, what I had plugged into was, I went from bulbs going from CFL to LED lights, because they apparently draw less current. Interesting enough, I took, I had a particular problem where, when I turned on my kitchen light, for example, to replace all three lights, and it's one of these, you know, a fan light, and we've got three lights below that. When I turn the lights on, when I put the LED bulbs on, I happen to be watching channel 13. Happen to be watching RF channel 13 on my television, and found the thing was getting all whacked out, and it didn't initially form a, you know, like the idea of, like, you turn the light on, it's going to be going towards the interference. One day, I was using my spectrum analyzer on pretty much on the frequency to look what the interference could have been, and I didn't see anything. And some just made for some reason I reached around and turned on the kitchen light to give me, you know, some more light. What I saw on the analyzer was a series of like half sine waves full of noise that went across where channel 13 was, starting about 210 megahertz. And they actually went down to about maybe 185 or something like that, and as high as about 230, 240, from what I could see on the analyzer, which is hooked up to one of my ports of the,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I heard that. And when I turned the light off, of course, the interference immediately went away. So, that's another reason why I'm asking, you know, something about that, because I have to build a filter or something that's going to apparently try to take that energy that's coming out of the light. So I don't even know if it's radiated directly from the light itself or it's being conducted backwards along the wiring that supplies power to these particular lights. So that's another reason I'm asking the same, because I'm going to have to come up with some sort of filter, which is probably end up going to be some sort of, I guess you want to call it something simplicity, a low-pass type of filter, where it'll pass the, you know, 60 hertz power, and everything much higher than that, it will kind of knock it out from being radiated in the wires. Back to you, Dick. That's I guess, the other half of why I'm asking this particular question.
Hey, you just hit a very critical area, Joe. A significant number of people are switching over to light-emitting diode lighting, and a significant number of those people are suddenly complaining about the electromagnetic interference. We first heard about this more than a year ago from Andy, WA2CDL. He put a whole lot of modern light-emitting diode lighting in his laboratory at his house, and he suddenly realized that it was bombing a lot of his electronics whenever he turned it on. Turns out that light-emitting diodes, they make a beautiful substitution for compact fluorescent lights, and they make an extremely good substitution when it comes to incandescent bulbs, if your criteria is efficiency. How many watts of electrical power do I put in, and how many lumens do I get out? Let me drop them. In general, the CFLs are more expensive than the incandescents. The light-emitting diodes are even more expensive yet than the CFLs, if you buy a good brand. It's an extremely competitive purchase, as I think, an extremely competitive product. And many of us run into sticker shock. In other words, I would love to take that 40-watt fluorescent tool that's in my major lighting in my laboratory, so to speak, and substitute with a light-emitting diode version of it. And if you look at the number of dollars required for that investment, you say to yourself, whoa, how many years do I have to use this before I get return on investment? So you shop around and you find one that's less expensive. Well, the less expensive one has a power supply in there that is really rich in harmonics and radiating through the power supply and so on. You buy the more expensive version. a significant rating as far as the electromagnetic interference it creates. It solves the problem, but now you've spent even more dollars on an expensive item. Lots and lots of people are now complaining about the radio noise they're getting out of their light-emitting diode lighting. Because it's so competitive, let me drop it. And the manufacturers are rightly predicting that many of us get sticker shock. We'd like to all flip over the light-emitting diode. We'd like to put 3 watts into what used to be a 40-watt bulb, and we're getting the same number of lumens. In theory, that kind of jazz is possible. But now, the power supply design that does that, it's got to be a constant current supply, it's got to be rated over all kinds of spikes and voltages that you put into it, over all kinds of temperatures, and so the design of the power supply is far from simple, and to keep it inexpensive and yet low in EMI is a real problem. You can make it cheap, fast, or good. Choose two. You never get all three. You can make it cheap and fast, but it ain't going to be very good. You can make it real good and fast, but it ain't going to be cheap, and so on, if you know what I mean. So there's a real rub here, and many a person has looked into the schematic diagram of that power supply of the light-emitting diode lights and tried to add the components, add the shielding, and so on. The basic design in the beginning is what's really the determining factor as to how much EMI the darn thing's going to create. And for you to do a retrofit on it, there are times when the amount of heroics required to do that retrofit to get the radio noise down to a level that you would like, you're going to be unhappy to find out how much effort that requires. So that's the real rub with light-emitting diodes, depending on where you're using them. Let's see how Eric has solved that one. I'll bet you you guys would like to use a light-emitting diode lighting on some of your broadcast studios, Eric, and to keep the EMI down, I bet you've got to invest some good dollars in order to buy a good brand in order to solve that problem. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, if I remember Andy's problem, he had electronic ballasts, which was putting in LED lighting. Many of the electronic ballasts are transmitted, literally. As far as the cost of LEDs, now my entire house has no CFLs in it, it's got no incandescent bulbs, it's all LEDs. And that was at the beginning when McCree was selling 6-inch, what do you call them? They recess into the ceiling. Can't think of it right now. Their power supplies are very clean. When you come to my house, you hear no. You really have to dig for the RFI that comes out of this stuff. I will say a couple things. That the tubes that were replaced for essence is still a tad on the expensive side, but the price of those things is coming down. Many of the Chinese LED single bulbs, not made by Cree, made by other people. Cree folks seem to care about RFI. I'm going to drop. Well, Cree is actually the manufacturer of the LED itself, but early in the game they decided they were going to be a lamp manufacturer. But there are a lot of Chinese, especially streetlights, where you have to generate a lot of amps for the LEDs. Those things are pretty filthy and dirty, I know, because I've done some RFI studies on a few of them for a power company down in Florida. While we were down there with one of my friends, we were trying to sell them LED bulbs, and I rejected like more than half of what they were trying to sell. As far as the studio goes, we don't use incandescent lights anymore. We use a combination of fluorescents and LEDs. Actually, the fluorescents are going by the wayside now that there's greater saturation of the LED lights. We're talking about specialized instruments that you're not buying for $2 a pop, so they're guaranteed to not emit anything. Well, some of them do a little bit, but the level is very low. And to put more salt in the wound, the FCC is currently having a number of studies done, which is also sanctioned by the SBE, which is the Society of Broadcast Engineers, that all of these devices are creating extreme interference on the AM band for AM broadcasting. And it's going to be not too long from now where the FCC finally puts manufacturers what they got to do. K2RW, K2J.
From what you know and what you've been hearing, Eric, roughly what percentage of the inexpensive, easily purchased light-emitting diode fixtures, either the fluorescent replacement or others, what percentage of the inexpensive ones do you think are likely to be significant electromagnetic interference generators? Is it 1%, 10%, 50%? Give me a very rough guess on what you have heard. If I'm buying the inexpensive ones, how vulnerable am I to EMI if I'm running a good radio laboratory? KE2EJ, K2LIW. I'm asking for a guess. I know this is a tough one, Eric. Go ahead.
All right, well, let me give you something that's factual to start with, which a lot of folks aren't aware of. Electronic ballots for fluorescence are the noisiest bloody things that there are, because they have to generate the high voltage for the tube. Those are the things that are the big problem. The actual little screw and LED bulbs are a little bit noisy. They're not that bad. You got to get really close to them, and if you'll notice, the newer ones now, they're actually building the power supply into, in essence, what you would call a Faraday cage. But of the bulbs that are out there, and there's a lot of scrutiny in terms of which ones can become UL approved because they care about RFI. And out there, most of the UL approved bulbs you can be pretty happy with in your house. But there's a lot of them that are CE rated, but they don't give a darn about RFI, and I would say it's probably in like the 20 to 30% range. But even those, because you're talking about small bulbs, low wattage, the amount of RF generated is less than many, even CFLs, so, you know, go whichever way you want to go. CFLs are not exactly quiet either. They're actually noisier than most things that you would consider. K2RW, K2J.
In your particular case, Joe, I get the impression it is not a electronic ballast for a fluorescent tube that you're working with. Yours is an electronic power supply for a real light-emitting diode lighting array. And you're now seeing on your spectrum analyzer lots of RF noise. And I've heard lots of people starting to say that these days. Out of curiosity, Joe, what brand name did you choose? Did you choose that particular brand name because it was not the most expensive one and you wanted to save some money? And most likely it totally did not come with a RFI rating. Only a guy that's selling a very expensive one is going to make the measurement and tell you the RFI rating. So we've got a conflict of interest here, as you can tell. Dollars versus EMI. WA2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
WA2RYY, they name it Eric mentioned Crowell, I think it is. If that's how it's pronounced, that's what the name is on the bulbs. I don't know if they're good quality, bad quality.